Terry W. Sturgis III and others from Jefferson County. The Torrington Company and Ingersoll Rand Corporation versus Sharon Sputzman and others from Jefferson County. And Stephen James Us versus Denny Short individually and as executor of the estate of Clifton Short and others from Travis County. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising our marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete these arguments by the lunch break. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee by making application with our clerk. Justice Baker is not sitting in the first cause, but he will rejoin us for the second and third arguments. We are ready to hear arguments from petitioners in Walmart versus Sturgis.
May it please the court. Mr. Kevin Jewell will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. It is a pleasure to present argument this morning. The court in this case, which involves an attempted but unsuccessful commercial real estate transaction. The issues that are raised here involve the plaintiff's tortious interference claim, and in particular, whether or not they have established the elements, each element of the tortious interference claim, including justification. We also have issues involving standing, the adequacy of the evidence to support the lost profit damage awards for both the tortious interference and breach of contract claims, and finally issues challenging the punitive damage award, as well as challenging the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the punitive damages should be reversed because the trial court erred in excluding other, quote, instances of tortious interference on the part of Walmart and other states, and that the case should be remanded for a new trial on punitive damages alone. I want to begin by addressing the meat of the liability claim here, which is the tortious interference cause of action by the plaintiffs.
Why shouldn't the rule in Sterner that justification is an affirmative defense apply in this case, the case for interference with prospective business relationships?
Well, first, I think that because we have a situation where a claimant is suing for interference with a prospective relief or a prospective contract, which is inherently, I think, speculative, it should be more difficult to recover under that circumstance. But I would also add that, in fact, the Court of Appeals, along with several other intermediate appellate courts, have concluded that it is the plaintiff's burden in a claim for tortious interference with a prospective contract to prove lack of justification. In this particular case, the Beaumont Court of Appeals held that, and Sturgis and the other respondents have not perfected any such appeal from that.
But this court has held that justification is an affirmative defense. It's the cause of actions for tortious interference with contract, analyzing the nature of an affirmative defense. Why would it not be a matter of avoidance in this case as it would be interference with tortious interference with contract? I don't understand the distinction.
I would think that to a certain extent it is a matter of avoidance, and if the court were to conclude here that in fact it is Walmart's burden or any defendant's burden to prove justification as affirmative defense, that in fact the record shows here that we have proven that as a matter of law. Specifically, as the court can recall from the briefs,
before you move on, do you have an answer to Justice Hankinson's question as to why there should be different treatment other than prospective contracts or more speculative?
Other than what I've said already, I don't have an additional answer. And to further emphasize that if in fact the Beaumont Court erred in concluding that it was the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate lack of justification. There are numerous other courts of appeals who have also erred because they've held similarly, and that our evidence here, viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, clearly shows that Walmart was justified in taking the action that they did.
You're basing your justification matter of law point on the ECR, right?
That is correct. Walmart, of course, was a party to each of the ECR agreements that were in place at the relevant time.
And you're saying that contractually gave you a superior right?
We clearly had a superior interest in the land. As the charge defined the justification issue, which was question number 7, the court said, instructed the jury, an interference is justified if a party possesses an interest in the subject matter equal or superior to that of the other party.
What about the plaintiff's contention that the interference alleged here had nothing to do with the rights under the ECR? It was totally independent of it.
Well, Walmart has... let me answer your question this way. Walmart possesses an interest in this subject matter because they are an existing tenant to this, or they were an existing tenant at that time to the shopping center. They own the right by contract to control the development of that land and to control the usage of that land. Now, the respondents presented themselves as nothing more than investors. They did not have any ownership interest whatsoever in this land.
Well, I understand that you're claiming you have a superior ownership interest by virtue of this agreement, but my understanding of their argument is this wasn't a situation where you were presented with something and you rejected that presentation that you had a right to do under the ECR. That my understanding of their argument is that you went outside the ECR through this agent and interfered with the deal. So it was not through the ECR that it happened. And how does that affect your superior right claim?
I don't think that has much of an effect on the case. The plaintiff's contention that Mr. Fuller, when he made a decision to reject the 1990 proposal made by Sturgis, was made, as he testified, based on his knowledge of the variances that were a part of that proposal and how they varied with the existing ECR restrictions at that time. Whether or not a particular person, be it Fuller or Mr. Hudson, the real estate agent, subjectively bought to himself or herself, I am subjectively considering these ECR covenants.
Well, in fact, Hudson didn't even know about the ECR, did he? I mean, if their liability is based on Hudson's action alone as Walmart's agent, and Hudson knew nothing about the ECR, what relevance is it that the ECR gave you superior rights?
Well, Hudson was simply instructed to go ahead and contact Fleming to find out who Sturgis was and who his group was. And if he simply communicates to Fleming, Walmart has an interest in expanding its property to cover into Track 2, and Fleming takes that at face value and says we don't want to do the deal, then that certainly is an act that is consistent with Walmart's right, not only as a contract or as a party to the ECR agreements in place, but also their right just as a party that is interested in the land just as much as our third estate.
Well, what if they had, if you do the deal with Fleming, we're going to move. And in fact, they had no intent to move. Could there be liability in that situation?
Well, I think that that may be a closer case if there was evidence that there was no intent to move on the part of the communicator, and that was shown to be a misrepresentation. I can see where that might invoke some liability. That was not the case here. And in fact, looking at it from another perspective, had Fleming gone ahead and contacted Walmart as Fleming's representative testified that they would have done before executing any lease with the services group, and asked Walmart, what are your future plans, do you intend to stay, et cetera, and Walmart says yes, or wants to provide, we're here for the long term, we're not going anywhere, and they do the deal, everything's done, the building is built, the plan is modified, and then Walmart decides later that it wants to move. And in that situation, Walmart would probably be sued. I'm not saying that would be a good suit, but they would probably be sued anyway.
So you can envision scenarios outside the ECR that would justify liability. You're not saying that the ECR gives you carte blanche to do whatever you want to with the property because of that contractual right.
Right. I don't think it gives us carte blanche. But clearly, in the circumstances of this case, Walmart had at least an equal right to what Sturgis Group had to attempt to obtain track two.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'm not sure I'm clear. I'm forgetting about the ECRs. Walmart is a neighbor on this property.
That's right.
And the argument is that Walmart kept Fleming from buying the neighboring property because Walmart essentially told them, well, we either are going to expand or we're moving. And you're saying that you believe there could be liability if a neighbor reflected to a potential buyer of the neighboring property that they just may move. And if they don't have any intent of moving, that could somehow create liability on part of this property owner to the next door, to an investor in the next door property whose deal was killed because the neighbor threatened to move. You're saying you think there's potential liability there?
I'm saying that if there was some sort of misrepresentation.
No, I'm saying I don't intend to move, but I don't want this guy moving next door to me, and if his decision to move next door to me is dependent on me staying here, I'm just going to tell him, well, I'll move if you buy. But I don't have any intent to move. I just don't want him buying that property. And you're saying there might be some potential.
I wouldn't say that I believe that there's any liability in that scenario. I won't say that I don't believe there would be liability in that scenario. I do want to correct one thing. I think maybe this said is that Fleming was seeking to buy this land. It was actually Sturgis' group that was seeking to buy track two and lease it to Fleming. And of course, there is a significant causal break here, as we've argued in the briefing, about whether or not Walmart's conduct actually caused Sturgis' group to not, or actually caused this deal to fall through. Sturgis himself admitted that the telephone conversation between Hudson and Callaway and Fleming was one of many things that caused the deal to go through. In fact, Sturgis testified that they would not have bought the land without a signed lease with Fleming already in place. And Fleming's representative testified that Fleming would not have signed the lease unless Sturgis had already bought the land.
Let me ask you a question and get back to the ECR. There were certain circumstances under which Walmart's approval or consent, reasonable consent, was not required for someone else to purchase the property and sell, correct? I mean, couldn't someone have bought the property and built, what was it, a 36,000 square foot supermarket on it, and Walmart couldn't have done a thing about it? There wasn't any consent that was required of Walmart to do that.
That's exactly right.
So Walmart did not have absolute control or any kind of veto power over everything that happened on that land.
Right. Under the language of the 1982 ECR, which was included in the 1988 ECR, Walmart had the power, the sole power, to request a modification to the agreement subject to or together with the written consent of OTR, which is the owner of Track 1.
Since your time is running out, let me switch you over to the question of actual malice relating to the punitive award. Respondents contend that the actual malice finding was consumed in, I think it was maybe issue 6. What is your response to that argument?
Well, of course, there is no, number one, there is no usage of the word malice anywhere in the charge. There's no definition.
That's not a correct construction on your part.
And I don't think the elements as defined in instruction number 6 about wrongful interference do not, in my view, establish the necessary requisite of malice to justify a punitive award, and actual malice being ill will, et cetera.
Were you required to object to that instruction then if it wasn't correct, or to that issue if it wasn't correct?
Being the plaintiff's
and did Walmart, and did Walmart do that?
I believe that an objection was made. I can double check that and make sure. I believe also that it is the plaintiff's burden to present the issues in accordance with the plaintiff's obligation and burden of proof. And if it's the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate malice, which it is in this case, then it's the plaintiff's obligation to make sure his charge is correct.
But doesn't the opposing party have an obligation to advise the trial court if it believes that the charge is defective, if the plaintiff is defective?
I think that under certain circumstances, that may be true. If there is a necessary element of a claim that is, if there's multiple elements and then one is omitted and then the defendant says nothing, that element can be deemed found.
All right. So is it your perspective that this is an omitted element then? Your position is not clear to me, and that's why I'm trying to clarify.
Not from the tortious interference point. We contend that it was the plaintiff's burden to submit an actual malice question in order to recover punitive damages.
Okay, and is it your position that they wholly failed to do so, or that they submitted a defective actual malice issue?
That they failed to do so.
All right, and did you object to the failure to do so?
I believe that we did. However, I cannot give you a pacing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Morris Gore will present argument for respondents.
Your Honors, first of all, one key point I think is this is an action not for tortious interference, but for wrongful interference with prospective contractual relations. This case was submitted under 106.3 of the pattern jury charges in conformance with that. At the time of trial, there were alternative submissions in the pattern jury charges for submitting this as an affirmative defense or as an element of the plaintiff's case. The key thing, though, with regard to burden of proof is you do not have that issue before you because Walmart specifically requested at page 793 of the transcript, you'll find Walmart's requested jury issues. Walmart requested that this be submitted as an affirmative defense. That's exactly what the defendant did at Sterner. The reason for that is it gives the defendant two bites at the apple. If the defendant had submitted this with the plaintiff's burden, it would just have been another line in the instruction to issue one. So we get a yes to issue one, we move on to damages. But what the defendant wants is two bites at the apple by submitting as affirmative defense, because if he gets a yes to issue, if he gets yes to issue one on the interference, the defendant can still win by getting a yes to issue two on his affirmative defense. So the problem I have with what Walmart is, they got their two bites at the apple at the trial court, and now down on appeal, they're here trying to argue that it's our burden. Admittedly, the Court of Appeals did cite some older cases that dealt with that issue, but it's just not before you because there's no issue preserved for appellate review by Walmart on the burden of proof. They not only did not object, they asked it to be submitted this way.
Well, assuming it is an affirmative defense, is the issue before us whether or not Walmart established that affirmative defense as a matter of law?
I think that's the only way that Walmart can win.
Is that issue before the court?
I think Walmart has raised the issue whether they've established justification as a matter of law.
Okay, and why do you think that Walmart has not established justification as a matter of law?
Okay, Judge, it's hard for me to explicate this. This was a three-week trial. I have set the evidence out in great detail in my brief, so I'm only going to give you a summary. Right now, I believe that the record in its totality, as set forth in my brief with record citations, clearly reflects that Walmart did not establish justification, but I attached to my brief the testimony of the call from Mr. Callaway. It was not the innocent call that Walmart represents it to be. It was an ultimatum to Fleming that says, do not build this store because Walmart wants to buy track two and expand on it. It had nothing to do with the size of the grocery store or the ECR. Now, we did want to build, the ECR in existence in 88 called for a 36,000 square foot grocery store. And by the way, the exhibit to the 88 ECR is attached to my brief as an attachment. The exhibit allowed for a 36,000 square foot grocery store and some retail space along the side. Well, as you know, the market's changed so that people now want these bigger, fancier grocery stores with all kinds of additional items. So what my clients wanted to do was build a 50,000 square foot, nice, super class grocery store as a neighbor. Now, my clients not only, they did this with the approval of Walmart all the way through. The record reflects that Mr. Sturgis sought from Walmart, what do you want to see on track two? And he was told, we'd like to see a really nice grocery store or a daycare center. So they went out trying to do that. They got a deal with Fleming. They submitted a plan to Walmart for their proposal. Walmart was told that was submitted to a Walmart real estate committee and approved. And in January of 1990, before Hudson's call, which occurred February 14th of 1990.
Well, let me ask you this. What if Walmart had decided that they did want to purchase that track, in fact, and that if someone else moved there, they were going to move their store? What if that were true and that were really their intent? Would there be any, what's wrong with telling someone that?
Well, I think, Judge, again, you're getting into an issue that is esoteric because it's not in this case. If you look at footnote 15 at page 7 of my brief, I detail the evidence here. What happened, if you look through the Walmart testimony, there's nothing done with regard to moving this store.
But this is just the converse.
Okay. Okay.
Would you agree that, as my question to your opposing counsel, would you agree that if, in fact, they did intend to buy the lot, and that if they couldn't get it, they were going to move their store, that there would be nothing wrong with communicating?
Just speaking in theory?
In theory.
Okay, in theory, if you look at Chapter 7 of the Restatement of Tort Second, which deals in general with this tort and related torts, they deal with the concept of improper interference. And they basically hold that it's sort of involved if you look at it. But what they're saying is you can, in some circumstances, do something that you might possibly have some legitimate right to do, but do it in the wrong way and create liability. Section 17, there is a section of the Restatement of Torts, second, that is 772. So they basically say...
What sense does that make? Suppose Fleming had originated the call and said, we're thinking about leasing this for a store. What are y'all's plans? And they said, well, if you do that, we're moving.
Okay, but...
Is there anything wrong with that?
Okay, maybe not, but I point out, Judge, that that's not the record before the court here.
Well, that's
theory. In theory, maybe so, but before the court... In this case, the evidence in this case shows that Walmart's executive vice president of real estate says we prefer to expand the store rather than relocate it because it's a lot cheaper.
But what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with the conveyance?
No, what's wrong with preferring to expand the store rather than relocate it and wanting to use the track next door?
And conveying that intent. What's wrong with that?
And saying to the other side, that's what we want to do. Yes, we want this track. We don't want you to have it because we'd rather expand. If we can't expand, we're going to move.
That's not what happened, though. I understand.
Is there anything wrong with that?
If it were done in a particular way, it might be okay. But what was done in this case was that Walmart gave an ultimatum, as Mr. Callaway characterized it, to don't build this store. And it had nothing to do with whether or not it was a 36,000 square foot store that was expressly permitted under the existing ECR or a 50,000 square foot store that had already been approved by Walmart up to that point in time.
Okay. What do you contend Walmart's ulterior motive was?
Walmart's motive was, the purpose of Walmart was to cause our deal to be canceled so it could buy Track 2 for itself and expand its store.
Exactly. They wanted to buy Track 2. Why don't they have an equal right to pursue Track 2?
Because my client had it under, we had the property under contract with the bank and a letter of intent with Fleming Foods, and that's a legally protected interest as a prospective contract that protects us from interference by Federal Park.
But if Walmart intended to move, that deal went through, and they're, I mean, they're entitled to move, what would be wrong with that?
Okay, I'm not necessarily arguing that it would be wrong. What I'm telling you is the record in this case reflects that Walmart did not intend to move, that that was a false.
It does. That was my original question to Patrick.
Yes.
Council. Where in the record is that evidence developed that in fact it did not intend to move?
Okay.
That was a ruse to...
Okay, I'm going from page 7 of my brief, footnote 15. Okay, the testimony of the three people involved, Thomas Say, Tom Hudson, and Watson, the pages are outlined there. That makes clear that Walmart had done absolutely nothing toward moving its store. Say says that the Vice President of Real Estate says we prefer to expand rather than move, and then Mr. Fuller, who's the corporate representative trial, testified that Walmart could have expanded toward the rear or could have expanded toward the other side if it didn't acquire TAC 2.
But none of that
was just their preference.
But none of that says that it was false, that if Fleming did lease the property, they would still stay where they were. None of what you just said.
Well, there's nothing in it.
Sure, they weren't planning on moving because they didn't think they'd have to.
Assuming it's an affirmative defense, Judge, that Walmart has to establish it as a matter of law, and Walmart would need to have in the record the fact that this was in fact the jury found it was not a good faith assertion of the rights. So the jury found they were not acting in good faith.
Going back to the motive, is your claim for interference with a contract or interference with a prospective contract?
Prospective contract with Fleming Foods.
So you did not have an executed contract with Fleming Foods?
No.
If you didn't have an executed contract, why does Walmart have an equal opportunity to try to pursue getting a contract to buy that land and to expand upon that land?
Because Texas law protects it's a separate cause of action for interference with prospective contractual relations.
So if I'm, just to use a different example, if I'm thinking about buying a house in a neighborhood, and I'm talking to the owner about it, and we're talking about, well, maybe we're going to sign a contract to buy that house, and somebody else comes in and says, well, I'm going to offer you more to buy that house, and they go ahead and sign a contract for it, I can sue him for interference with a prospective contract because I was about to enter into a contract to buy that house?
No. That's a different case.
How is that different?
This case, we had a letter of intent with Fleming Foods. The letter of intent set out all of the terms, and that's an exhibit in my exhibit to oral argument. This pages here for 45. That's included in the exhibit today. According to the evidence shows, this set out all the terms of the build and lease agreement with Fleming. We had, the evidence also shows the deal was ready to go to Fleming to be signed. If you reach a verbal agreement with the property owner to buy that house, y'all got an agreement, you prepare a contract, you know, you go over, y'all got a deed, you reach the point. The distinction, what you're talking about discussions. I'm talking about a deal being made. If there's a deal made, and the contract is being drafted, and at that point in time somebody else interferes, that's what you're interfering with, protected interest.
Well, I submit to you that's going to wreak havoc in the Austin real estate market. But that aside, what happens not uncommonly is that somebody will strike a deal, and then somebody else is going to come in and offer more.
Well, are you suggesting then that there's no cause of action for interference with prospective contractual relations? I mean, it's a recognized cause of action.
It strikes me, though, that it depends upon the justification defense, depends upon whether Walmart said something that was true or not true. that if it did intend to move, if it couldn't buy that lot, that that's something it was free to communicate to the world, whatever the repercussions might be, if that's what its true intent was. But if it just said that to bust the deal, knowing it didn't intend it, and that would seem to me to be the distinction, and that's why I keep asking about the evidence that was a false statement that they had no right to make. That's my understanding of their justification defense outside the ECR context.
Okay, there's no evidence in the record to show any intent to move.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's talk about that. I've got a vacant lot next to my house, and I know that there's some agents out there looking at the lot, and they're thinking about doing something with it. It could be developed, I don't know, it could be a shopping center, it could be a sports center, it could be another house. I don't know what's going on. They come to me and say, you have a problem with us putting apartments over here. And I say, no, I don't have a problem with that. And they go off and they get a letter of intent with a developer or somebody to put in some apartments over there. And then my wife finds out about it and just gives me all sorts of grief and said, you tell them right now, if they build apartments over there, we're moving. And I go and find out, well, lo and behold, the only reason they want to build apartments over there is because I live next door. And I tell them, look, you know, you build apartments, we're out of here. I have no intent of moving. I have no intent of moving. But if they build those apartments, my wife says we're going to be moving. So she just doesn't like them. She just doesn't want them over there. Am I now liable for having told the developers that, you know, well, if you want us living here, I have some bad news for you. We're not going to be here.
Yeah,
am I liable for tort interference?
I think under the standard, as I read it, discussed in the restatement of tort second, I think you potentially could be, given those facts the way that you've developed them, you know, based upon your representations initially, that you would do it and their reliance on that and going forward. I think that creates a potential problem for you. Again,
now, let me ask you this. Let's take Fleming. Was it a critical piece of information for Fleming to know that Walmart would be their neighbor?
I think Fleming wanted Walmart as their neighbor, Judge.
And because Walmart told them that they might not be their neighbor, there's some liability for tortious interference there. Now, getting by intent,
the
conveying that piece of information made Fleming decide they didn't want to buy the property.
But the problem, though, the big problem is not really hinged upon Walmart as the neighbor or not the neighbor. You know, you like, as a retailer, you like to be next to people where there's activity, people going in and out, because you hope you pick up on that. But you don't want to...
So Fleming didn't care whether Walmart was its neighbor or not.
No, I didn't say that. They wanted to be next to Walmart, but the thing that they didn't want to do was be next to a vacant building. As a retailer, that is something that you want to avoid. You do not want to be next to a big vacant building.
Well, let's look at the inverse of it. What if Walmart intended to move, but didn't communicate that to Fleming?
I don't think Walmart has any obligation to communicate that to Fleming.
So if they had approved the deal and the alterations to the ECR, the whole time intending to move and never communicating that, there'd be no liability?
I don't think so. I don't know of any legal duty of Walmart to communicate what their intentions are. The procedure for Walmart moving a store is pretty involved. Walmart is, before Walmart will move a store, they go through a very rigorous process, and the final decision is made by a personal on-site visit by five members of the executive committee. You know, they personally visit the site, and those five people sign off on it. Walmart moving a store is the same as opening a new store. It's a huge investment, and it's an involved process that you have to go through. I mean, there's no guarantee that Walmart, even if they wanted to move, would have wound up thinking that was the better decision.
Mr. Gore, I thought I heard you say earlier that the parties here had a deal as reflected in that letter of intent.
Yes.
Are you saying the parties had an obligation to go forward under the terms of that letter of intent?
No, it was a typical letter of intent.
But there wasn't a deal.
Well, I'm saying
there was a basic framework for a transaction if the party decided to move forward.
Well, there was a deal, Judge, in the sense that all material terms had been agreed upon.
What if your client had gotten a better offer because they had taken it?
Better offer?
Another tenant.
No.
Come in and said,
no. My clients had a deal with Fleming Foods.
Could Fleming have walked away from the deal, so we're going to go across the street?
Okay, the history of this deal, my clients have been trying to develop this track since 1980.
I'm just asking, under the terms of the letter of intent, could Fleming have walked away and gone somewhere else?
Yes, Fleming was not obligated. Under the letter of intent was a letter of intent. It was not, did not rise to the level of a forcible contract. It had all of the material terms of the Fleming lease already agreed to. We were to the point that the evidence shows that the deal was to the point of being ready to submit to the Fleming Food Home Office to sign on the lease. Now, there's some controverting evidence that Walmart thinks it's going to raise for potential problems, but the evidence, I believe, shows that those would have been overcome.
As I understand your brief, though, Mr. Gore, Fleming got out of this deal because they learned Walmart either wanted to expand or it was going to move. And Walmart conveyed that information to Fleming, and that was the tortious interference. If the information about Walmart's intent was critical to Fleming, such that he either decided to do the deal or not do the deal, then I have trouble understanding how Sturgis claims that he was wronged by Fleming being given some information that was critical to his determination whether or not to pay money to Sturgis. It seems to me Sturgis would have had an obligation to convey that information, whether Walmart had a present intent to move or not a present intent to move, but as a part of the deal with Fleming, Sturgis would have had an obligation to give exactly that same information to Fleming.
But again, there was no intent to move as reflected in the record in this case.
Whether it was or was not, wouldn't that be a piece of information that would be important for Fleming to know to make their own decision whether to risk that is the truth or not? Fleming doesn't want to buy the property if that building's vacant next door. And if Walmart either wants to expand or move, and really they want to expand, they really want to expand, but Fleming's not going to permit them by age purchase, not going to permit them to expand. It seems to me that becomes a piece of critical information for this prospective buyer. Wouldn't Sturgis have an obligation to convey that at some point?
If it were submitted in the correct way as truthful factual information, Judge, I'm sure that Sturgis would pass that on. But again, the point here is that Walmart did not intend to move. Walmart's only intention was to expand its store. Walmart made a representation that it would move for the express purpose of causing the cancellation of my client's transaction with Fleming, so that Walmart, to kill the deal, so Walmart could buy Track 2 or sell. There was no intention to move, and there's nothing in the record to show that.
Mr. Graham, let me see if I understand your position with respect to the procedural posture of the case. Taking that evidentiary discussion and putting it in the context of our question, which is, did Walmart establish the affirmative defense of justification as a matter of law? Is it your position then that they failed to establish it as a matter of law because there is no proof that the representation made in that phone call was true?
Right. They did not.
The truth was part of their requirement to,
yes,
show as a matter of law.
And there's no evidence of proof. In fact, the only evidence in the record reflects that the statement was untrue, but there's not even any evidence of proof, and it certainly does not rise to the level of truth being established as a matter of law.
And that's critical to their prevailing as a matter of law in that defense.
Absolutely, because they, and the other thing I'd point out is the current version of 106.3 only has justification as an affirmative defense, and they cite Trevillo v. Gonzalez as authority from this court as authority for the proposition that justification is an affirmative defense in a prospective contract. Again, you don't have that issue before you because Walmart.
Let me ask you this. Just if we write the standard
the way you want us to write the standard. I want to see how it plays out in this hypothetical factual situation. I own a piece of commercial real estate that I want to sell for $1 million. And I enter into a letter of intent with you for you to purchase it for $1 million. But there is no earnest money contract signed on it. Well, lo and behold, next week, Walmart comes and offers me $1.1 million. If I were to say, okay, Walmart, I'm going to sell it to you for $1.1 million and ignore the letter of intent that I've entered into with you, would both myself and Walmart be subject to tortious interference with your prospective contract?
Well,
under your standard that you want us to write.
No, the distinction here is that the owner of the property is protected by the statute of frauds if he hasn't entered into an agreement. But there's cases that...
Would Walmart be subject to tortious interference?
Yes. Walmart would be tortious
for
the
all?
The cases support that, Judge, because the cases say that the unenforceability of the contract is not a defense. There's specific cases on that the statute of frauds, even though it may make the contract unenforceable, it doesn't preclude a cause of action for interference with the agreement. You know, once you reach a level of having a deed, you know, that's likely to go forward and close, there's a protected property interest. And Walmart or anybody else is precluded if they know about the deal. If it's innocent, that's one thing. But if Walmart knows about the deal and Walmart intends to cause cancellation of the deal, intends to wreck it, acts with the purpose of harming plaintiffs, which is what the way the issue was submitted and the way jury found is purpose of harming plaintiffs, which is the Texas League cabin of the five elements of actual malice, then if you satisfy those elements, then yes, you're lying.
Well, the purpose is merely to get the land for yourself. There's no actual malice. You just want the land.
Well, I think actual malice, to me, purpose of harming is you're trying to stop the deal. I mean, the business tort is not, if you were to say you've got to have ill will, you've got to hate this particular person, you're not making it a business tort, you're making it a personal tort.
Why shouldn't we make the standard an enforceable contract as opposed to a letter of intent?
Well, you'd be changing the law if you did that. I think that you do away with the tort, because if you're saying this tort has been recognized since the 1400s, I mean, this is something that's rooted. This is not a new tort I'm asking you to enact. This has roots back to almost the Middle Ages. And you would be wiping it out if you say you've got injured contract. But that's a different cause of action. Tortious interference with an existing contract is a different cause of action.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Counsel. Mr. Jewell, help me. I've got a bit of a disconnect here. My understanding of your justification as a matter of law defense is that you have superior rights under the ECR and that you never attempted to establish justification as a matter of law based on the fact that Walmart, in fact, intended to move.
Let me first emphasize that before we get to the justification issue in question 7, the jury first had to answer question 6, and which defined the wrongful interference tort, which included showing that Walmart intentionally prevented the contractual relations from occurring, and that's the lease with Fleming, with the purpose of harming the plaintiffs. Now, our argument is that there is no evidence of any purpose on the part of Walmart on these plaintiffs.
Well, if they did not intend to move, there would have been no other purpose for that phone call.
The purpose of the phone call was to find out, as was testified to, was to find out whose service was, because he had no interest in the land.
Well, it went beyond that. I mean, if in fact Walmart had no intent to move, just take that as a given for now. I realize you dispute that on the record. But if they had no intent to move, then their only motive for that phone call and the information that was communicated that they would move would be malice, as defined in question 6.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think part of the conversation that is had there also has to do with just the fact that this is just a business.
But the jury could have certainly inferred that.
that Walmart had no intent to move?
If the evidence was that Walmart had no intent to move, then could the jury have inferred malice from the phone call? Let me get back to my original question. On the justification as a matter of law defense, you're basing that on the ECR, correct? And not on any sort of argument that Walmart did or in fact did not intend to move. It's strictly on the ECR.
Well, we do base our argument on the ECR. That's true. And our rights, as justification was defined to this jury, that we possess
superior
subject matter superior or equal to that minimum.
Under the ECR.
Under the ECR.
All right.
But also, Walmart has just as much of a right to attempt to expand on that land as to the service group. Just as a business investor, and they have every right to contact Fleming to determine what Fleming's intentions are.
Not if what it communicated was false. You'd agree that it did not have the right to communicate false information.
Well, I would agree that might be true in a certain circumstance. There is no evidence here that anything that was said was false.
But is there any evidence, though, assuming that Walmart had the burden on this affirmative defense, is there any evidence in the record that the matter that Walmart communicated was true?
Well,
is there any evidence in the record that that was true, that Walmart intended to move?
Again, I'm not sure how that works in with the definition as given to the jury.
Yes or no?
I don't have a page set for that, and I can't tell you to a page set, but I can probably, if the court will allow, find something for you. But if we focus on what the definition of justification was as given to the jury, then these prongs, or one of these prongs, is established in the record as a matter of law.
Which prong?
If a party possesses an interest in the subject matter equal to the superior of the other party, or if it results from the good faith exercise of a party's rights, or the good faith exercise of a party's mistaken belief of its rights.
What about the fact that the plaintiff had this piece of property under contract with the bank to purchase it? How does that play into it?
Their claim is not based upon the earnest money contract.
On this affirmative defense. Is there any evidence in the record that the matter that Walmart communicated was true?
Well,
is there any evidence in the record that that was true, that Walmart intended to move?
Again, I'm not sure how that works in with the definition as given to the jury.
Yes or no?
I don't have a page set for that, and I can't tell you to a page set. But I can probably, if the court will allow, find something for you. But if we focus on what the definition of justification was as given to the jury, then these prongs, or one of these prongs, is established in the record as a matter of law.
Which prong?
If a party possesses an interest in the subject matter equal to or superior of the other party, or if it results from the good faith exercise of a party's rights, or the good faith exercise of a party's mistaken belief of its rights.
What about the fact that the plaintiff had this piece of property under contract with the bank to purchase it? How does that play into it?
Their claim is not based upon the earnest money contract. Their claim, as it was presented to the jury, is based upon their prospective lease with Fleming.
Well, no, I understand that, but when you go back to just this subject matter idea and interest in the subject matter, as I understand the argument in your brief, that what you're saying is that Walmart had an equal or superior interest in the property itself by virtue of the ECR agreement,
well,
right? Is that correct?
That's true.
All right, well, how does that play in light of the fact that the plaintiffs had it under contract with the bank?
The plaintiffs had an earnest money agreement of temporary duration in which there was an opportunity for Sturgis to seek to obtain approval or to obtain a modification of the restrictions on that land.
All right, so how did in the face of that, how does that rise to the level of being as a matter of law?
Well, because Walmart's rights to the land as they existed at that time were superior clearly superior to whatever rights Sturgis Group had, or Sturgis, which was, I think, the only signatory on that earnest money contract, had under that earnest money agreement. Now,
any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.